One of the reasons I don't think it's really going to help the planet was summed up very succinctly by a professor called Miles Allen, who works with the LEAP School at the University of Oxford here and has served on the IPCC's committee. And he was quoted as saying that, yes, we could eliminate the methane from cattle, and we eliminate, this is, get rid of them all. And this would impact and lower temperature, global temperatures by a few tenths of a degree over the next 20 years. But, he said, if we do not get to grips with the global warming being caused by fossil fuel consumption, pretty much everything else is irrelevant. This is something that has come to people's attention recently, that the thing we used to think about agriculture, which is it's quite normal to plow up the land every year and to replant and to regrow the same monocrops on that land and just keep feeding it with fertilizer. That was a way of farming which was encouraged because it was supposed to be high yield. And in the post-war period after the 1950s, it was going to generate more yield and feed the world. And it became the norm. And it's only been recently that many farmers have realized what that was doing to the soil, which is it's destroying the nutrients in the soil, destroying the carbon content and the organic matter in that soil, which results in less water retention, leading to floods, with less carbon storage, which is why we have a problem with excess carbon in the atmosphere. Way to look at it is that businesses stand to profit. So many businesses involved in the processed food industry or involved in agribusiness do stand to gain from this world in which cattle no longer exist. So, this whole opening up of the vegan processed food market is like a manna from heaven for some of these companies. They've just been given a carte blanche to create a whole bunch of new products, highly processed products, and the money is in the processing. Everybody knows that. If you're producing simple food, you're not getting very much at the farming level. But by the time you've added all the processing, that's where the profit lies. So that's what companies have to gain, pure and simple. And when they talk about these products being better for your health or better for the environment, and they cause fewer greenhouse gases, etc., this is just pure marketing.
Welcome to the Radical Health Rebel podcast with your host, Lee Brandon. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating and a warm review.
Your opinions are important,
and your ratings help grow the podcast and help educate people to lead a healthier, more productive,
fulfilling and happy life.
If video is your thing,
please check out the Radical Health Rebel YouTube channel, where you'll find fun bite-sized clips from each episode.
And now, here is Lee, the Radical Health Rebel, with this week's podcast.
Welcome to episode 22 of the Radical Health Rebel podcast. This episode is entitled The Great Plant-Based Con with Jane Buxton, Part 2. And follows on from episode 21, where I interviewed Jane on whether a plants-only based diet was optimal for human health. If you haven't watched or listened to that episode, I suggest you do so before listening to this episode. In this episode, Jane explains whether a plants-only based future is the solution to save the environment and to prevent global warming. So enjoy part two of this interview on the Great Plant-Based Con with Jane Buxton. So the other thing we haven't spoken about, Jane, is quality of food. Now, obviously, the other thing that has to be considered is the quality of the food. As you mentioned, you spoke about earlier about, caged animals. If an animal is living in a 6x6 or even smaller cage, and they have to do everything in that space, including going to the toilet and eating the food, and they don't get any exercise, well, You can't produce a healthy animal in that environment. And, if you compare that to an animal that can roam freely and eat its natural diet, so for instance, for sheep or cows, that would be grass rather than grains. you know, that's the other thing that we really need to take into consideration when we're talking about a healthy diet. It, you know, it does, again, it makes a massive difference, because if you've got toxic chemicals in the soil and you're growing plants in the soil, well, then you're going to have toxic plants. So, you know, that's another thing that often people don't consider is, well, I'm vegetarian, therefore I'm healthy. But actually, if it's not grown in healthy soil, it's not going to be healthy. You know, it's going to be
Well, that's the point.
So it's going to be nutrient depleted, because when they put the chemicals in the soil, it kills the microorganisms that actually create the nutrients for the plants. So that was just something I wanted to mention before we move.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And we have evidence that the nutrients have declined in some of our vegetables over the year. Now, the extent to which they have is much disputed, and there are a number of studies, but there is a decline. There is definitely a significant decline. And that's because the soil, as you say, that cycle of feeding back nutrients from the soil into the plants is not taking place. And there are other reasons too. You know, because some plants are picked too early in order to transport them and get them over to the other side of the world. And that affects the nutrients in the plants too. So there's all kinds of things in our current food system which act against high quality, high nutrient density food. So you're quite right. We need to think about the whole thing in the round. And it becomes a really complicated issue. And we can talk about the benefits of eating grass-fed beef, not only for our health, but for the environmental impact and the health and the welfare of the animal.
Yeah, so my next question is, do you think a plant-based diet will help to save the planet?
I think that, you know, I could answer you that no very quickly as well, but I'll try and be more expansive. One of the reasons I don't think it's really going to help the planet was summed up very succinctly by a professor called Miles Allen, who works with the LEAP School at the University of Oxford here and has served on the IPCC's committee. And he was quoted as saying that, yes, we could eliminate the methane from cattle, and we eliminate, this is, get rid of them all, and this would impact and lower temperature, global temperatures by a few tenths of a degree over the next 20 years. But, he said, if we do not get to grips with the global warming being caused by fossil fuel consumption, pretty much everything else is irrelevant. That's a big statement. Everything else is irrelevant. So, yes, we could have some impact if we stopped eating meat. But it would not make a difference that would be significant enough to the world and to global warming. It's a bit like rearranging the deck chairs, you know? That's what it is. And in countries such as the UK, that is particularly the case, because the emissions that are generated by cattle and sheep, for beef cattle and sheep, amount to approximately 5.8% of our total here. Well, transport of all kinds is 24%. You have industrial and residential use, that's about 35%. You have energy at another 20%. So you have these massive generators of emissions and this tiny, tiny one over on the side, which we're paying way too much attention to. Now, that is also, you know, that point is made more significant by the fact that those emissions, I believe, are exaggerated in the first place. So there are many ways in which the emissions allocated to cattle are disproportionately high. So one of those problems is that we're using a metric which is not really suitable for measuring the emissions from cattle. So we're using a metric called GWP100 instead of the new recommended metric, which is GWP star. And so the old metric, the 100 metric, It has been acknowledged overstates emissions from cattle by about 3 to 4 times. Overstates the warming effect of emissions from cattle by 3 to 4 times. That's pretty significant, 3 to 4 times overstatement. You know, there are numerous ways. Those numbers don't take into account sequestration. Now, your listeners are probably aware of what sequestration is, but in case they're not, sequestration is a process by which a practice, a farming practice, can help the soil to draw carbon out of the sky. So it's a net benefit to the environment. And cattle raised in the right way, on the right pasture, can create those conditions for sequestering carbon, for storing it underground, which is exactly what we want. And that's where it should be, not in the sky, underground. And that the ability of cattle to do that is really underestimated in all of these numbers. And people talk about these numbers, these emissions numbers, as if they're fixed in stone, as if they're accurate to the 10th degree. They are a moving target. We are constantly learning that one sector has more, another sector has less. Just last week, it was reported that the methane from industry has been vastly understated. So we have to stop pretending that we have this fixed emissions pie and that we know exactly who's contributing what to it. It's much more of a movable feast than that. It's much more complicated. And in the process of trying to simplify it, we're demonizing cattle, which is actually probably the least important of all the problems that we have to fix. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't do better.
Yeah,
we can do better, right? We can do better by implementing practices, regenerative farming practices, more widely, because they're not very widely used, and improving that sequestration ability. So that's where we really need to be moving.
Yeah, absolutely. I know this isn't something that you wrote in your book at all, and it's something that I've been looking at for a few months now. You spoke about global warming, but have you listened to any scientists recently talk about global warming?
I have. And I'm very much aware of, I believe where you're going with this is whether we're exaggerating the warming effect, whether it is actually made by man-made activities and that kind of thing. Is that where what you're?
No. So I've listened to
a
few experts recently, and they say, but the Earth hasn't warmed for 20 years. There is no actual warming. And there's a lot of people that have completely denying that it's even warming at all anyway. That's not to say we shouldn't stop pollution, but they're actually saying that there is no global warming and there hasn't been for 20 years.
I'm aware that there are people that are saying that. The science that I have been looking at does show that there has been global warming, but that it follows a cyclical pattern. And we don't know the extent to which human activities are driving that pattern or affecting that pattern. You know, it could be a lot, could be a little. It is happening. But for instance, sometimes it's disconnected from human activity. So in the period directly after the war, emissions were going down and industrialization was going up. So it sometimes it doesn't make sense, the connection between human activity and global warming. It isn't a subject that I choose to engage much on because I need to be heard on the environmental impact of cattle. That's what my battle is. The environmental impact of meat inclusive diets is where I want to be working and arguing the case. If I start to get into the whole question of does global warming even exist? That's a major distraction in terms of the ability to solve this one problem that I'm facing. Is that clear? Am I making myself? Yeah. I think you can only take on so many battles at once. But yes, I'm aware that there's a lot of fluid science out there. The science is not settled on many of these issues.
When I was interviewing Matt Letissier the other week, you know, because me and Matt are the same age, and he was saying to me that you know, oh, do you remember back in the 70s, we were told that you know, we were about to go into an ice age, and that we were all being scared to death that we were about to go into an ice age. And then, you know, there's other people that have said, well, by the year 2000, most coastal towns will be under 20 feet of water. And then you look back mm-hmm. now and sea levels are exactly the same as they were 40, 50, mm-hmm. 90, 100 years ago, you know? So I guess we have to be a little bit careful what we believe, I guess.
Yeah, and it's very, very difficult. Mm.
So you've spoken about methane, but I know you also speak about carbon dioxide in your book as well. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, only that methane has become the bad boy in the story. Methane is what's generated by cows burping. I notice that most of the time people talk about methane and they talk about cows and they say cattle are responsible for 30% of man-made methane. Now, that's very convenient because it makes the cows look quite bad. The reality is that cows are responsible for 15% of all methane because much of the methane that is generated is natural. It comes from natural sources. So one of those natural sources is wetlands. So wetlands generate more methane than cows. And that's not a story you hear very often when people are talking about doing rewilding and let's transfer the pasture over to wetlands. You know, it would not result in a net reduction of methane. So methane is misunderstood. At the same time, the difference between methane from different sources is also misunderstood. So the methane from the cattle forms what is known as a biogenic cycle. So it is coming out of the cows and it goes up into the atmosphere. It is converted by hydroxy radicals into carbon dioxide, which is then absorbed by the soil that the cows are trampling on and making better and making more capable of absorbing carbon dioxide. So there's a kind of cycle there which does not exist with industry. So the kind of methane that's coming from factories, from industrial plants, or the carbon dioxide which comes from those is a different category altogether. The carbon dioxide, which comes from fossil fuel use, is coming out of the ground for the first time. There's no cycle in there. There's no limitation on it. It's out of the ground into the atmosphere. That's why it's so dangerous. That's why really Miles Allen is correct when he says we've really got to address that or everything else is irrelevant. So,
gotcha. Another thing you talk about in the book is, I guess, the criticism of livestock and their use of water and land. Can you talk a little bit mm-hmm. about that?
Yeah, so in terms of water first, it's often said that, you know, cattle are a big water hog. And if you look at the totality of the water that they use, you could reach that conclusion. But the fact is that 95% of the water which is used by cattle is rainwater. It's not irrigated water. It's not dredged up from lakes. It's not nothing. It's not brought in. It's rainwater. And that water would fall on the ground, whether the cattle were on the ground or not. So it would just, if the cattle were not there eating the grass, then that rainwater would just really kind of go to waste in a way. So it's not a net draw on the ecology of the system. So land is connected with that in a way, because what would happen if the cattle weren't there? Well, the cattle do take up a lot of land. It's undeniable that a great deal of the world's farmland is used for cattle. It's also true that 70% of the world's farmland, and the percentage is very similar in the UK, 70% of that land cannot be used for growing crops. So it can only be used to grow cattle, as it were. You know, a farmer who I interviewed, he raises pigs and he raises cows in Devon. And he said, you have to grow food in the right place. And what grows in Devon is grass. You can't grow anything else. It's very hilly. And it also grows cows very well because cows love the grass. So you're growing these two consistent forms of food and nourishment in the right place. You can't, it's extremely naive to think that we could just simply get rid of the cows, change all that land over, and grow food on it. Now, a lot of people say, the current argument is, well, we don't need to swap that land over. What we'll do is we'll rewild it. Take the cows off it and rewild it. And then we'll grow, we'll take a little bit of the land and grow some more crops. Again, I think the numbers that I've seen from studies that purport, that argue for that case are very dubious. And there's a lot of work still to be done on whether or not that's possible. There was a study done in Scotland by a group of researchers called Lennonin et al. And they discovered that in the Scottish environment, for instance, if you were to swap over from animal protein to plant-based protein, the amount of land that you would require to grow those plant-based proteins would be just the same as the amount of land that you're using already to feed those cattle. So you're not really getting a gain in land use in an environment like Scotland with that particular topography and everything else. So it's super simplistic to look at that kind of land use and make judgments on the basis of that alone. The other thing which I find annoying, irritating, and again, overly simplistic is when people say cattle take up 80% of our land and or the earth's land mass, agricultural land, and they provide just 18% of the calories. As if calories were the point of everything. Calories are not the point of everything. Protein and nutrients are the point of everything. So, yes, livestock take up a lot of land. They provide close to 50%, I think, or 40%, sorry, of protein. And that protein is immensely more higher quality, more bioavailable, better protein than the plant protein. So you begin to think, well, is that such a terrible trade-off when we're getting that quality protein out of the land? Yeah. You know, but you won't see the Guardian using the protein number or the nutrients number. If you add nutrients in there, it's even worse.
Yes. Well, we'll come on to someone that funds the Guardian, but not just yet.
You're listening to the Radical Health Rebel podcast.
Are you regularly suffering from painful bloating and wind that can be smelly and embarrassing? Are your bowel movements not as they should be, either constipation or diarrhea, or possibly alternating between the two? Do you find the pain is bad enough, but the bloating and cramps make you feel awful and are affecting your everyday life? Do you sometimes feel you can't eat properly because of the wind, bloating and pain? And has your doctor told you that you have IBS, but unable to help find you a solution? Do you feel right now that you simply don't know what's causing your symptoms and whatever your doctor has suggested hasn't worked? And you feel frustrated that you're still far from having a normal, flat, comfortable tummy? Have you invested a lot of time, energy, and money into improving your symptoms and don't wish to waste any more? Do you feel frustrated and depressed and don't feel like you can take part in all the activities you enjoy and sometimes have to cancel attending events because of the way your tummy feels? Do you fear that if you don't get this sorted, you could end up with a much more serious gastrointestinal disease? Well, if so, what would help you right now is to understand the root cause of your digestive condition rather than continuing to try to mask the symptoms with over-the-counter or prescribed medications. You need help understanding how factors such as nutrition, gut health, stress, and toxicology affect the digestive system and how to optimize these factors. You need someone who can advise, motivate, and support you every step of the way, someone who has walked the path before and taught many others to do the same. What you need is my Overcome Your Digestive Issues program. My Overcome Your Digestive Issues program can help you in the following ways. I will help you understand the root causes of your digestive problems and teach you how to approach the condition holistically via expert advice on nutrition and lifestyle factors. The Overcome Your Digestive Issues program will start by ensuring you are on the right diet for you based on your genetics or metabolic type, and one that avoids the foods that are known to exacerbate your condition. We'll go on a journey step by step, learning all the necessary lifestyle changes required to achieve a flat, comfortable, pain-free tummy. Each weekly 30-minute coaching session will include advice, support, and guidance specifically tailored to your needs and at a speed that is right for you. Once you're eating right for your metabolic type, you will begin to see changes in how your tummy feels, and we will also uncover all the necessary blocking factors that you may have, and you'll be taught how to reduce, replace, or eliminate all the factors that are causing your digestive problems. Ultimately, this program will enable you to achieve a flat, calm, and comfortable tummy every day for the rest of your life. For more information about how to improve your gut health and to claim a complimentary no-obligation gut health consultation, please go to www.bodycheck.co.uk, that's B-O-D-Y-C-H-E-K, and fill in the request form at the top of the homepage, and we'll be in contact to arrange a convenient time. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah.
So with regards to farming practices, can you talk a little bit about things like monocropping, ploughing, and tilling?
Yeah, so this is something that has come to people's attention recently, that the thing we used to think about agriculture, which is it's quite normal to plow up the land every year and to replant and to regrow the same monocrops on that land and just keep feeding it with fertilizer. That was a way of farming which was encouraged because it was supposed to be high yield. And in the post-war period after the 1950s, it was going to generate more yield and feed the world. And it became the norm. And it's only been recently that many farmers have realized what that was doing to the soil, which is it's destroying the nutrients in the soil, destroying the carbon content and the organic matter in that soil, which results in less water retention, leading to floods, with less carbon storage, which is why we have a problem with excess carbon in the atmosphere. So there are numerous problems which are caused by that way of farming. And farmers are starting to move to what they call regenerative practices, which do not ever till the soil. They don't overturn that soil. So they don't disturb it, the life in the soil, and they don't release the carbon. And it's a difficult way of farming initially to get to grips with, but a lot of farmers are finding it immensely beneficial, and they're actually measuring the benefits in their soil. So here, there's a farmer called John Cherry who founded the Groundswell Festival, which has thousands of farmers attending it every year who are just talking about these principles, trying to learn from one another, trying to implement them on their own farms. And he said, we were so stupid for so long, we didn't realize that we were destroying the soil. And now I can see it. I can see it coming back. I can see the life on the farm coming back, the birds, the bees, butterflies, the other habitats, because we're not disturbing that soil. We're protecting it instead. I'm not pretending that's easy, and I'm not a farmer, but.
Yeah, I remember seeing a documentary a few years ago, and there was a lady who, she inherited this farm. She grew up on the farm, but it was her farm. And she was saying, look at this video from 1974. And her dad was on the tractor plowing the land, and there were flocks of birds following the tractor. And then she said, watch this now. So she got in the tractor, started plowing the field. There was no birds. None. Yeah. Not one. And, that's just an illustration of what you just said. You're just killing the wildlife. Mm. What's that? Mm-hmm. What do you think that's doing to the environment? You know?
Yeah, and that's why I find it amusing that the Audubon Society in the States has a phrase that they use, which is "What's good for the herd is good for the bird." So that's an acknowledgement of the fact that if you are raising cattle on the land in the right way and allowing those cattle to do their thing with the soil, pooping on it, trampling on it, eating the grass to the right level, you know, they not right down to the ground, but the managed level, that's good for the herd. It's good for the bird because the birds have something to eat. They're feeding off the insects and the poop. They've also got habitats there because of the ground, the way it creates those habitats. And they're not being poisoned by the kind of chemicals that you often find associated with monocrop agriculture. You know, those great huge fields of corn or soy, which are, you know, grown year after year with the help of artificial inputs, that is no good for wildlife.
Yeah, I was thinking as well, as you were talking, you know, plowing obviously kills animals, right? If there's a mole, soil and a plow comes along and, you know, it's going to decapitate the poor thing, you know?
And the earthworms and the fungi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously the other thing is if you're not monocropping, obviously you've got more than one crop in the same field. What often happens is that, you know, plants have different, they have different root structures and they're reaching out to different levels, actually taking different nutrients from different levels of the soil. So you're even, you know, it's better for the soil. It's better for the vegetables as well if you're not monocropping.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of farmers are now wanting to move back to that way of farming, that mixed farming and the rotation. So you're and so you're using cover crops to protect the soil in some years. Your cattle graze on those cover crops, which gives them food. It rests the soil. You don't have to plow it, and then you're rotating and you're growing a wider diversity of plants as well. So It's that's the goal. I'm just not sure we have the right government policy right now to assist farmers to move in that direction.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we have actually, I'm just going to mention something that is quite apparent today, and I don't want to go into it too much detail, but, you know, it's pretty disgusting what's happening in the Netherlands at the moment with the farms. I don't know if you're up on that.
Do you know, I'm not, I've been following it only in the same way everybody else has. I'm not an expert on what's happening in the Netherlands, and I think it's extremely problematic the way they're going about the change. But it's also, the Netherlands is problematic because they're quite an intensive farming country. You know, they're farming a lot of animals and a lot of crops on a small amount of land. So, it is true that intense farming, it isn't something that we should be looking to see as part of our future. How you transition from one form to another is the question for that government. And I think there are a lot of questions to be asked about whether they're doing that in the most fruitful, humane, you know, and supportive way for those farmers. And I would suggest probably not.
Yeah, I mean, in episode five of this podcast, it was called "If I Was the UK's Health Czar," and one of the things I suggested was that we transfer over a 5 to 10 year plan to change our farming methods. Now, I at the time I said organic, but actually, I looking back now, I should have said regenerative. And you know what they're obviously doing in the Netherlands is saying, well, you need to change tomorrow. And not giving the farmers any time, not giving them any time at all to make that adjustment. Yes, we want to get rid of that kind of farming, but you can't just do it tomorrow. It's going to take time. You might say, right, these farms in this region are going to go first, and it's going to take them a bit of time, and we've got to support them while they do that.
Yeah. So that strikes me as tick box policy, isn't it? It's sort of, we need to tick the box of immediately reducing our nitrogen and our emissions. So we're going to do that in one fell swoop by getting rid of everything. Whereas the other policy, which you're talking about, which would be supporting farmers through a transition, might take 5-6 years to have an impact on the temperatures or on the amount of emissions, let's say. So it's politicking. It's not really helping. It's politicking.
So we've got a famous computer billionaire who is heavily invested in some of these fake meats, and he's also heavily invested in genetically modified crops and wanting to patent every seed on the planet and have us pay him so that we can eat. What are your views on these fake meat products and genetically modified foods?
I'm not a fan, which won't surprise you, but I think when we look at the fake meat products that are on the market right now, so Impossible, Beyond, and the copycats, they are relying on, to a certain extent, genetically modified ingredients, the monocrops, which are farmed in GM form. And I don't want those in my food. And I think most people don't want them in their food. So that's something that's being overlooked when we talk about those products as being beneficial to our environment and to health. It's also far from proven that those products are equivalent to the product they're trying to replace. And in fact, there's a lawsuit that you'll probably be aware of against Beyond Burger, which is because it's made false claims about the nature, the amount and the nature and the quality of the protein that it's providing. So if consumers think they're getting the same product as the natural product, as the animal product, then they're mistaken. Now, as to why Bill Gates is doing this, why he will be invested in this technology and what he sees to gain, that's speculation, and you know, that's probably another topic, but it's something that we need to be aware of, that he is invested in both of these technologies. And I believe is also a supporter of cell-based meat and those technologies. So, and that's another form of the fake meat that we're seeing. It's really early days for that meat, but there are, you know, a minimum of 30 startups which are involved in creating that cell-based meat in different forms using really highly complex array of patents. So there are a couple of things that we need to be wary of with those products. First of all, that they cannot but have a centralizing effect in our food system. Mm. So they're going to concentrate, if they ever came to market, if they ever became the main form of our protein, they would concentrate the supply of that in the hands of very few very rich companies with patents to back up their rights. And that strikes me as exactly the wrong way to move our food system. We need to be moving towards a more decentralized, more community-based, more localized food system. And so this is moving exactly in the wrong direction. But it's also questionable whether they will actually achieve the kind of scale that they claim they can achieve and become the go-to protein replacement. There are innumerable problems being experienced right now by these cell-based meat companies. You know, the scalability of their technology is far from proven. They simply can't make it at the scale that they would need to. There are immense difficulties with a contamination when you move to those bigger scales and when you're moving from a, you know, 25-liter tank to a 250-liter tank and many of those in the same room. They're so far from being scalable and available and affordable that it really beggars belief why we talk about them as a solution now to our problem, why people talk about them as if they're right around the corner, because they're really not. In fact, Good Food Institute, which is a big support, you know, it's really a marketing organization. It sounds like a lovely name, the Good Food Institute, but it's a marketing organization for these alt meat companies. It commissioned a report about the state of play in the industry, which was very damning. Its own report was very damning about where they are, what they have achieved, and how realistic it is. So I don't think we should be counting on those products. If they ever do achieve any place in the market, it'll be a very niche product, very expensive product. It's not going to feed the masses.
And a lot of these vegetarian kind of alternative meats, if you like, what effect does that have on the environment?
When you say the, do you mean the Impossibles, yeah, the Beyonds, the ones that are made from plants? Or
yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, interestingly, the other day a study came out from Our World in Data, and that study looked at a whole range of those alt meats versus the real product. And it showed, like most data from Our World in Data, which is also funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, of course, so there's a link there too, it showed that animal proteins were vastly more environmentally costly than these fake meats. The difficulty with that, there are two difficulties with that. First of all, the numbers that they had in terms of emissions for real meat were based on a study that was done a couple of years ago by Poor and Nemechek, which is the go-to study, which really overstates the carbon costs, the carbon emissions associated with meat in some parts of the world by up to 6 times. So I know that it overstates UK beef by 3 times. And in some parts of the world with some beef, it's overstating it even more. So that's damning the real product before you even get out of the gate. The other thing, which is not mentioned by Our World in Data, is that those fake products are not nutritionally equivalent. They're not the same. So to say that they have a lower carbon cost is really pointless unless you're looking at the range of nutrients, the quality of the protein, and comparing apples with apples. So I think we're very far from being at a place where we can conclusively say that these fake meats are better for the environment than the real. And there's also the case, of course, that the water content of those, they come out with a lower water content because they are factoring in the water that's rainwater that's used for beef. So they're stacking the dice against the beef product when you see these kind of comparisons. And Our World in Data consistently produces these comparisons. And they're the ones, unfortunately, that are the go-to source for many vegan activists and vegan writers.
Am I right in suggesting that a lot of the crops that are grown to make these are from the Amazon? Is that correct?
I don't know if they're precisely from the Amazon, but they could be from deforested land. Yeah. Deforestation is an interesting topic. Again, I was engaged in a debate with somebody a couple of days ago about this. There's a chart which shows that beef, for instance, or cattle is responsible for 41% of deforestation. If you look closely at that chart, at all the other categories of food, you can see that if you put those foods together, the cereals, the sugar, the rice, the other crops, and the seed oils, the oils, you know, soy and palm oil, they come up to this more or less the same amount of deforestation. And yet we have a debate which is slanted towards nullifying and getting rid of the one product, but doesn't really talk very much about getting rid of the others or reducing consumption of the others, right? So deforestation is a problem for agriculture. Yes, we need to stop clearing valuable land which can store, you know, the world's lungs, as it were, that can store the carbon, breathe it in. We need to stop clearing it. But it's a much more complicated problem than we're led to believe. And it's not, you know, simply saying eat less beef is not going to fix it. That's for sure.
The Radical Health Rebel
is also available on YouTube.
Find bite-sized clips from our episodes on the Radical Health Rebel YouTube channel.
Just a brief interruption to this podcast to talk about adult acne. Now, did you know that 40 to 54% of men and women older than 25 years will have some degree of facial acne, and that clinical facial acne persists into middle age in 12% of women and 3% of men? I know only too well the devastating effects that acne can have on your confidence and your self-esteem, and how it can easily destroy your social life, your career, and your relationships. I know this only too well because I suffered from severe cystic acne from age 13 to 31. Over an 18-year period, I visited my doctor on many occasions, and his only suggestions were acne creams, harsh cleansers, and antibiotics that weren't working and were actually making my skin worse. After 18 years of struggle and thousands of pounds invested in treatments that didn't work, through my professional education, I began to learn that what my doctor had told me was untrue, and that diet was directly related to acne, plus other factors such as food sensitivities, toxicity, hormones, and balancing the body's microbiome. Putting what I had learned into practice, I managed to rid myself of acne over 20 years ago and have been helping others to do the same for well over a decade. By teaching people what foods cause acne, what food sensitivities each individual has, how to optimize their detox pathways, how to reduce environmental stresses and toxins, and how to balance hormones, especially those related to the mTOR pathway, a major causal factor with acne, I've been able to help many other adults overcome their acne nightmare too. So if you would like more information on how to overcome your adult acne, please go to www.skinwebinar.com. That's www.skinwebinar.com. where you can also request an acne breakthrough call with me to see if you are suitable for my Eliminate Adult Acne coaching program, where you can once and for all learn how to overcome your adult acne. Now, back to the podcast. So do you know if, you know, let's say we had to stop eating meat by 2030, which seems to be the plan, would they be able to grow enough crops to replace that meat with the same amount of land that there's livestock on, or would they need more or less?
They claim, so Our World in Data, Pora Nemacek, claim that we would be able to grow enough crops for everybody to be vegan with just 1 billion hectares of land. So, and that's less than we're using now for agriculture. So that is the claim. I think it needs to be interrogated, and I believe that there are scientists who are working on interrogating the actual assumptions underlying those claims, because it isn't I don't know the extent to which that takes into that, not those numbers take into account the quality of the land, whether it can be transferred, whether the amount of land that they're talking about can be transferred, whether there's a comparable quality to the proteins that they're talking about, whether the nutrient deficiencies in plant proteins are accounted for in that calculation. You know, so if you factor in nutrients, another interesting study came out last week, a couple of weeks ago, that concluded that most people need to get at least 50% of their protein from animal sources in order to get not only quality protein, but with the amino acid content, but the surrounding nutrients that go with that. Not only that, so that's a minimum of 50% from animal sources. For some groups, they found you need 60 to 65% from animal proteins. So that's women under 50, people, men and women over 65. So you're talking between 50 and 65% of protein needs must be met for health reasons by animal sources. So the very fact that we're talking about reducing the land, getting rid of those animal sources and moving towards a vegan diet where we're growing those products on this reduced amount of land, I don't even know why we're having that conversation if it's going to be unhealthy for humankind. So it seems to me to be a moot point. It gets back to the whole idea of, is land use really a waste if it's providing valuable nutrient-dense food for people to survive, thrive, be healthy, stay out of hospital, raise their kids in a way that's healthy and raise kids that aren't stunted? What is the point in freeing up land and rewilding it if we have a malnourished population as the price we're paying for that? So I don't like discussions that take land use in isolation from food quality and human health. And I think we need to merge those conversations. And that, I'm afraid, is something that Our World in Data, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which funds it, they don't do that very well. They keep those entirely separate, those discussions. Mm. And they should not be.
Yeah, that leads me very nicely to my next question. And again, this is something that you touched on in your book. Mm-hmm. Who stands to benefit from the plant-based movement?
A whole range of people, organizations, bodies. And the way I describe it in the book is not that these people are all acting together, you know, coordinated by some puppet master at the center. They are all acting in their own self-interest. And it just so happens that it's all the same to the same cause for them. So the simplest way to look at it is that businesses stand to profit. So many businesses involved in the processed food industry or involved in agribusiness do stand to gain from this world in which cattle no longer exist. So, you know, this whole opening up of the vegan processed food market is like a manna from heaven for some of these companies. They've just been given a carte blanche to create a whole bunch of new products, highly processed products, and the money is in the processing. Everybody knows that. If you're producing simple food, you're not getting very much at the farming level. But by the time you've added all the processing, that's where the profit lies. So that's what companies have to gain, pure and simple. And when they talk about these products being better for your health or better for the environment, and they cause fewer greenhouse gases, etc., this is just pure marketing, mm-hmm. Nothing else. There may be people within those organizations who really believe that and who also are dedicated to that, but it's primarily marketing. And so I think most consumers do recognize that, thankfully. I think they're beginning to recognize that increasingly. Mm. Other sort of groups within society, you know, these NGOs, the non-governmental organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, like the Eat Lancet, like the World Economic Forum, they gain simplicity and control. So if they can streamline the world's food system around one diet or the prescribed model of a diet, and mandate that be produced in the most efficient way possible, maybe moving production from somewhere like the Netherlands, for instance, to somewhere else, and controlling that whole scheme, I think that's what drives them. Mm. They are technocrats who want to develop that kind of solution. Mm. So with the best will in the world, what they're doing is they're ignoring local communities, local needs, local dietary needs, individual dietary needs. The individual doesn't count within those systems. It's just the system that counts. Mm. So they have to gain, you know, power, influence, they get more funding, they get backed by these corporations. So they're a nice little partnership working together. The, you know, the Eat Lancet Commission, for instance, and the program is supported by an organization called Fresh, which is basically made up of the world's processed food and chemical and drug companies. So we should be suspicious by even just looking at that list. Yeah. What on earth is a drug company doing influencing food systems?
Yeah.
It's just wrong.
Yeah. Well, they obviously, so I was just going to say, they obviously stand to benefit from a sick population, the pharmaceutical industry.
They do. They do. The other curious player in this is the media, because I think there are a couple of different motivations for the media. There's some parts of the media, and we touched on it earlier, some parts of the media are actively gaining financially from supporting this plant-based cause. So the Guardian took funding to the tune of $2 million from OPP, which is a philanthropy organization in America, which one of whose main goals is to turn the world vegan and to protect animals and to advance the animal welfare cause. So right there, you have a direct financial incentive for the Guardian to err its reporting on the side of the plant-based cause and to be entirely critical of livestock. That's not to say that the Guardian hasn't done some good work and exposed some real issues in farming, because it has. But it's to say that the influence is swaying it much more in one direction than another. And I'm not sure the public are really very aware of that. I don't think most people reading those articles in The Guardian realize that they are funded, paid for by this OPP. So that's an example of direct monetary gain. But most of the time, I think the media gains because they love headlines, they love clicks, and boy, you know, the plant-based cause just provides those. This study after study, epidemiology provides weak data, which is then summarized in press releases, which go to journalists who don't interrogate anything, who report those studies on the front page under headlines such as "Eating a vegan diet cuts your chance of an early death by 50%" or something similar. And you'll have seen those every second day. I see them every second day. Invariably, when I dig into the study that's being reported, it doesn't say what the article says it says. So it's weak science that is just a wonderful supply of constant headlines for newspapers that have to fill their pages every single day of the week.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's any more sinister than that. It's just lazy journalism.
Yeah.
But maybe the media is the biggest influence of all on this because of that, because it's so powerful. It's so ubiquitous. The message is always so in our face. It's hard to counter that.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen the media have quite a big influence on the world in the last 3 years. But that's another episode.
Absolutely, yeah. You let me know when that episode comes on, and I'll listen.
So, what would be your advice to people on, you know, how should we eat?
Well, a couple of principles. First of all, how should you eat? Well, try and ignore 90% of what you read in the newspaper, for a start. Or ignore 90% of what everyone tells you should eat, whether it's a superfood will prevent cancer or another food will cause cancer, or you can ignore all that. If you do choose not to ignore it, then do your own research, find the studies, find out if you think you're impressed by them, and then make your decision. Okay. But mainly, I think we can go a long way by just eating real food that our grandmother would recognize as food, real food that we have purchased the ingredients of and that we know how it's cooked, we know what's in it. You know, Dr. Malcolm Kendrick is a fantastic doctor, great writer, and I rely on his work a lot. And he said, you know, you really, for most people who don't have special allergies, special conditions, eating real food will get you a very long way. A variety of real food, make sure it has some animal source foods in it, make sure it has a few vegetables and fruits and some healthy fats. You probably don't need to get more complicated than that. And if you do want to get more complicated, if you feel that you don't respond well to carbohydrates, for instance, if you listen to your body and you know, like you were saying earlier, you can tell by your energy levels and by your hunger levels, your satiety levels, whether you're eating correctly. So I guess really listening to your body is the other golden rule, isn't it? Yeah. So eat real food, listen to your body. That's probably it.
Yeah. Yeah. So most of my audience will know who Paul Cech is. And he said, if it wasn't around 10,000 years ago, don't eat it. And if you can't pronounce any of the ingredients, don't eat it, which is pretty much what you've just said. What I would add to that is, based on my, you know, last 26 years in practice, is that the way to get healthy is to live in alignment with nature, getting sunshine, breathing fresh air, get your feet on the soil or on the sand, eat real food, sleep in alignment with the time that the sun comes up and the sun goes down. And if you live in alignment with nature, that's going to help the environment as well. If you try and poison everything, then you're going to ruin your health and you're going to ruin the environment at the same time. I think it's something you alluded to earlier as well.
Yeah.
Keep it simple, you know. I would also add, try and buy from local farmers rather than big corporate supermarkets. You know, most of what they sell is damaging to your health and it's damaging to the environment. So get to know your local.
And the farmer's not getting a fair crack.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we need to buy direct from farmers a lot more. Until they take that option away from us, but we'll have to fight to keep it, I think. Awesome.
Yeah, well, we'll be fighting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're not going to give up, are we?
I'm certainly not. I mean, for me, it's a life or death situation that we're facing here. So I'm definitely not giving up. Excellent. That's been great.
Yeah. One of my next concentration, my next project will be to figure out a way to get this message into the ears, the heads of younger people, and to get it into schools and to have a simplified version of it that can really help cut people off at the pass in a way before they get sucked into this other way of thinking about food, the whole sort of plant-based vegan, the lure of that. We've got to get to young children and help them learn about farming and food at an early age.
I might have to hook you up with someone. She's got something she's got something called the Kitty and Custard Club, and it's about educating youngsters on exercise, movement, nutrition. So she might be someone you can work alongside.
Oh, yes, please do. That'd be great.
Awesome. Well, I was actually just going to ask you what's next, and you've just answered the question even before I asked it.
Well, there we go. Yeah.
So, Jane, where can the audience purchase your book?
Well, all good bookstores, but you might have to hunt at the back because a lot of bookstores are nervous about having it on their front table because it invites controversy and maybe a few, you know, vegan activists throwing things at their window. It's on Amazon as well. I'm on Twitter under Jane Reese Buxton. If you want to follow me and the debate and the ins and outs of where we're going with this.
Yeah, again, I just want to say it's just a fantastic book. So if you've enjoyed this interview, definitely get a copy of the book. It's just a fantastic, fantastic read.
Thank you so much.
Jane, thank you so much for taking your time out today to share your research with the Radical Health Rebel listeners and viewers. And to all the Radical Health Rebel tribe, if you know someone who would benefit from watching or hearing this episode, and I would suggest that's everyone you know, please make sure to share the love and forward it on to them. After all, the mission of the show is to help people lead a more fun-filled, healthy, productive, fulfilling, and happy life. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can at patreon.com/radicalhealthrebel, where you can also receive lots of other exclusive premium content, including unedited, full-length, ad-free video episodes, Ask Me Anything Q&A sessions, and Radical Health Rebel merchandise. So that's all from Jane and me for this week. But don't forget, you can join me same time, same place next week on the Radical Health Rebel podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Radical Health Rebel podcast
with Lee Brandon.
You can find Lee at
www.bodycheck.co.uk.
That's bodycheck.co.uk. Please hit the like button and share on your social media.
And with someone you feel will benefit from watching this episode.
So together, we can help them lead a healthier, more productive, fulfilling, and happy life.